Right now, it is time to bring in David Terechuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and he has his own terrific website, themediabeat.us, and we are welcoming this morning. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, hello. I'm glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, joining that trenchant man in the trenches of public radio, Marshall Miles. I guess we have to join the media guessing game this week, right?
Absolutely.
Among a lot of media guesswork going on, not least about Ukraine, which I guess we'll talk about later, but this guessing revolves around who is going to be our next United States Supreme Court Justice, now that Stephen Breyer is retiring after nearly 30 years on the bench, when he became known, of course, as the voice of liberalism, albeit somewhat centrist liberalism. Often, and increasingly in recent times, we know a voice that was raised up against well-stacked odds of conservatism in opposition to him. He's been credited, though, with influencing decisions among the nine Supremes in a liberal direction. Let's put it at that. Though, of course, he's been less successful more recently with the supermajority of 6-3 on the bench after Donald Trump was able to install 3 new conservative justices during his administration. But for the purposes of identifying Joe Biden's most likely replacement, members of the press have been given a fairly rare gift with this upcoming nomination. President Biden did already provide them as candidate Biden with 2 very clear parameters defining his choice. He announced that if given the opportunity, he would appoint, because it was clearly overdue, a black woman. So, one black female judge already well known in Washington is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. She currently sits on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and she's often dealt with government-related cases, like, quite famously, her judgment in 2019 that compelled then-President Trump's White House counsel, Donald McGahn, to obey the congressional subpoena he faced to give evidence about Trump's effort to obstruct the then-ongoing Russia-related investigation, you remember. In her judgment, she said very clearly, in a very short but crisp sentence, presidents are not kings. It's a pretty classic definition of where the Constitution stands when it comes to presidential abuse of power. She also judged against the Trump challenge to Congress, this time a lot more quickly than that earlier case, when she judged against Trump in his effort to avoid a subpoena to release White House documents relating to the January 6th invasion of the Capitol. It's worth noting about Judge Brown Jackson, that the Senate, it was the same Senate as is currently composed, approved her appeal court nomination by 53-44, a vote that saw 3 Republicans supporting her. You know, bipartisan to some degree, but, you know, it's bipartisan by today's standards. The Republicans included Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, but also none of those bellwethers, though how reliable he is these days is hard to tell, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And there are more judges, of course, who could qualify. Over there on the West Coast is another black female jurist who could be nominated, Justice Leandra Kruger on California's Supreme Court. She's well known in the federal system, having acted as a deputy solicitor general for the country as a whole in the Obama administration. In fact, she argued many cases before the Supreme Bench then. And one more, well south of here in South Carolina, is Judge J. Michelle Childs of the Federal Circuit there, who by coincidence is already about to go before a Senate confirmation hearing next week, because she's been nominated to the appeals bench in the D.C. Circuit. No reporter covering the Biden campaign can ever forget that he made that promise of his about nominating a black female Supreme Justice from a podium in South Carolina. during that state's Democratic primary, and he went on to win the state's support for his own nomination for the presidency, a crucial win for him. So that's important. We'll all recall also that, you know, in the background there was South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn. He helped Biden a lot with that win, and he's a champion for Judge Childs, not least because, as Jim Clyburn has been making very clear to reporters this week, she has a blue-collar background, and she attended the University of South Carolina, not Yale or Harvard like the other judges we've been talking about. If she were Biden's choice, that would even further alter the socioeconomic demographic, if you like, of the nine Supremes as a whole, who tend to be somewhat white-collar and Ivy League educated.
It'll be interesting to see. If it comes down to a vote in the Senate, it's obviously going to be 51-50.
I would expect so.
We haven't heard from the two renegade independent Democrats.
Well, we heard some few hints.
Yeah.
They would have to come up with a very good reason to vote against a presidential choice on this particular issue. But we'll see.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens there. Now, this does weigh heavy on, I know, my mind. I'm, you know, 69. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember that quite well, and the discord with Russia. And now the Ukraine really has blown into a situation that is precariously almost out of control.
Well, sure. It's the Ukraine story is one of signaling, outright international semaphoring and big flag-waving kind of form, often through briefings being given to the different nations involved, their most influential media outlets. Constant propaganda war, effectively, is what's going on. Primarily, this has been between Moscow and Washington, but other European capitals like London, Berlin, and Paris. And though, you know, the Ukrainians themselves, under their president Volodymyr Zelensky in their capital Kiev, or Kyiv, as we should more properly pronounce it, they also get to have their say, although they can't help feeling that they're a bit like pawns in this game. And sometimes the signaling can get very confusing, and certainly, as you say, ramping up the sense of tension. The whole thing for Western diplomats, just as much as for journalists, boils down to trying to read one not very scrutable man's mind, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin of Russia. Maybe he's planning a full-scale invasion deep into Ukraine to seize the capital and overthrow the government, or he may be seeking less dramatically to annex more territory in eastern Ukraine, carving out a corridor perhaps to link Russia with Crimea, and Crimea being that Ukrainian peninsula that Russia already grabbed back in 2014. But then again, he may want a fuller but still comparatively small war, if I can put it that way. A minor incursion was the phrase that President Biden himself used, in which Russia might, in its own terms, and it will certainly publicize it this way, would be saving Kremlin-backed separatists in that largely Russian-speaking Donbass region of the far east of Ukraine. And at the same time, while doing that, of course, they would manage to degrade Ukraine's armed forces. There could be, in any one of those scenarios, what we would recognize, I think, as some kind of pretext for invasion being conjured up to portray some offense to Russia that had to be remedied or revenged by military action. That's been the pattern before with the Russian Federation or the Soviet Union before it, as you were referring back to the missile crisis of 1962. In the Crimea, for instance, and elsewhere, going way back, and as I say, happening in other countries I have my memory too. When I was a reporter of the at the insanely inexperienced age of 19, I was covering a side angle to the 1968 Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, and then the manufactured pretext for their action was a letter of invitation from some of the Czech Communist Party leaders inviting their Soviet comrades into their country to, the phrase was, to protect their own revolution there. The Russians accepted the so-called invitation, of course, and they came to the aid of the party, 200,000 of them rolling in on 5,000 tanks. So reading the runes and trying to discern what might really be going on for Putin is a complicated exercise. And the press, of course, are putting a lot of effort into it, consulting the best and finest analysts they can. Because, you know, with all those threats, it could still be said that today's Russian leader, Putin, could be bluffing in a way that previous ones perhaps weren't. maybe he's just hoping to get maximum concessions out of the West, the United States and NATO, in order to keep the peace. Biden administration is certainly basing some of its tactics on that belief, responding to the Russian demand for written assurances that they will not do what Moscow doesn't want them to do. A long, closely argued written document that the United States gave Moscow in reply, but it offered all sorts of bits and pieces of things. Small matters compared with the major issue, and on that there was no sign of the one big main thing being demanded by Moscow, a written promise never to give Ukraine membership of NATO. That was made very clear, but at the same time, as in all, you know, sensible efforts at diplomacy, a lot of wiggle room was left on the other issues, like missiles being placed in places like Romania, close to Russia, and to Russia's mind, at least, certainly the way that Putin expresses it, that is a very clear threat against Mother Russia. Now, it's interesting to see the background to this. Putin's own semaphoring has taken the form recently. It's not been reported much in the mainstream press, but he wrote a remarkable document himself, and his hand is pretty clear in the writing of this. It's a huge document. It's almost a dissertation at 5,000 words or so, called On the Historical Unity of the Russians and the Ukrainians. He swivels between seeing the Ukrainians as just the same as the Russians, and on the other hand, a complete opposite concept of them being a complete threat to Russia. Other times, he seems to believe that Ukraine doesn't even exist as an entity of its own. And I'd point you to the London Review of Books, which is more than just a review of books. One of its best writers, James Meek, has done a very careful analysis of Putin's thesis, as it's being called. It's well worth reading. But don't expect a confident prediction of how things will go from it, though. Even Putin's own foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, seems, according to some reports in the last couple of days, himself somewhat unsure about which direction the boss will decide to go.
It's just wild to sit here and look at all this, and then in the background you have China and Taiwan. There's just so much going on. But before going there, let's switch over to Boris Johnson. And you know,
let's switch over to Boris Johnson.
You know, what's interesting is
another man with an inscrutable mind that we have to try and figure out.
Yeah, here we have the January 6th Commission, and now there it's the Gray Report, and it hasn't been released yet, and now there's doubt that it will be released. If that's not released, could that be the final nail in his coffin?
Well,
he's got more lives than he can.
It's always premature to predict the end of Boris Johnson. He's a Harry Houdini character in many ways. But Sure, the evidence is piling up, and you know, the remarkable thing about Boris that he can appear to, because of a kind of compact he's got with his sympathetic audience in the British public, and they still remain. There are still Boris lovers. He's always got a wink and a nod agreement with these people that he's because he's such a jolly and amusing character. This speaks to a particular strain in the British character, I'm afraid, that I'm not proud of as a formerly a British citizen. I'm still a British citizen, but I'm now a much more of an American citizen. I don't know where the balance is, but of course I have my roots there, and I recognize the cultural sort of game that's going on here. It's a nod and a wink, as I say. He can do the most outrageous things, but he's somehow traded on his personality as the naughty boy who gets away with things. And I'm afraid that's that same syndrome is just repeated here. He can even do the things, all the things that the COVID restrictions insisted that the public as a whole do not do. He can attend parties, I mean, even his own birthday party, and claim at the same time that he didn't know it was a birthday party to celebrate his birthday. And all those extraordinarily whoppers, as one of the English slang phrases for a big lie goes, he can do all that, and yet somehow or other get away with it. On the other hand, in the words of civil law attorneys, you know, the preponderance of evidence is building up against him, and certainly the mechanics of it are available. One of the most interesting things is that one of the first Conservative members of Parliament, that's a member of Boris's own. See, I'm falling into it already. I think I'm on a first name basis with the Prime Minister. Like later, everyone calls him Boris. One of the important things is that the Conservative who was first to move in the direction of creating a no confidence vote against Boris Johnson, which would be the mechanics by which he would be removed, was the leader of the Conservative Party in Scotland. Scotland is a part of the UK in which Boris has very few friends, and the Conservative Party is being reduced to a minuscule stature there, mostly because of him. So much so that the Scottish Nationalists are actively encouraging. They keep saying to in public sort of open letters and open calls to Boris Johnson to come visit Scotland, because every time he visits Scotland, his poll ratings go even further down, and he'll usually say something anti-Scottish or something that is read as anti-Scottish by the Scots, and so inevitably the first member of Parliament on his side of the aisle to write a letter openly asking for a vote of no confidence against him is the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. And because of the calculations of the size of the Conservative majority in Parliament at the moment, if there gets to be 54 of such calls amongst the Conservatives, then there will have to be a vote called on whether the House has confidence or not in its Prime Minister. And if that happens, then it'll be very interesting to see whether or not he can survive. That's a much more serious thing than any of the challenges that have been coming up along the way so far.
Interesting, very, very, very interesting to take a look at what's going on in the major countries across the world. So are you preparing for snow in New York City?
Well, it's another guessing game. it's pretty clear that one of the effects of global warming is erratic weather patterns. And sure, we are expecting a storm, and it probably won't be as big for us in the city as it will be for you further north or for eastern, more easterly parts of New York State in Long Island, where it'll get a lot more, I suspect, than the city does. But who can tell for sure? Not yet, and we're now something like 10 hours away from its expected arrival. There's one media story I'd like to bring up, too.
It's absolutely.
Another conflict on a very much smaller scale than any of the things we've been talking about so far, almost ridiculously smaller. But it involves a little bit more bluffing, perhaps, and disentangling how much a bit of bluff is seriously intended. And it's a battle in media land itself. The biggest audio streaming service in the world is, of course, the originally Swedish company Spotify, with Apple Music, I guess, in second place. Spotify has become a flashpoint in the battle over disinformation and free speech online. In the red corner, you might say, we have Josh Rogan, the comedian and podcast host with a huge audience and a massively lucrative contract with Spotify, reputedly $100 million. He regularly airs seriously misleading misinformation, disinformation, in fact, about public health issues, especially, of course, COVID. And over in the blue corner against him is the veteran rocker Neil Young, who's been so offended by the misinformation that he said publicly he wanted all his music off of the platform if they didn't stop spreading Rogan's lies. His actual words were that Spotify, and I'll quote directly, can have Rogan or Young, not both. He was supported, too, by over 1,000 doctors, scientists, and other healthcare professionals who signed a like-minded letter of protest. And it turned out that he was not bluffing. He followed through. And so now you have to go elsewhere if you want to hear Neil Young's music online. Apple, Amazon, Young's own website, and, of course, YouTube. Spotify looks like it's more wedded to the appeal that they believe Josh Rogan has, and they emphasized in their statement to the press just how seriously, here's a little bit more direct quotation, just how seriously they take their great, I want to get this phrase just right, great responsibility in balancing both safety for listeners and freedom for creators. The freedom for creators to spread health endangering lies, it seems. So we have a little fight about a big issue.
Well, I give Neil Young a lot of credit for asking him to pull it off. It's at this point in his career, he's been known as a liberal progressive or renegade and someone who. Even separated himself from his own group, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, very, very independent. And these internet companies, Spotify, Facebook, there's so many different, they're like onions. There's so many different levels to them. You really, the only way you can get any satisfaction if you're upset with them is to cut your tie, because you'll never get through all the layers.
That's true. In the end, he used the pressure of his own publishing company and recording companies to press against Spotify. But it's a debatable argument, of course, who's won now. He's off the platform. But as I say, you know, it's possible to find his music elsewhere. So he may have scored at least a Pyrrhic victory, in the sense that we all know now where he stands and where all his fans stand. And there are, it has to be said, aging rocker though he is, he still does have a lot of listeners. His classics are, of course, a staple for middle-of-the-road radio-type broadcasting, and the platform obviously includes that particular bracket too. They will have lost a lot of listeners in this. Quite how many is very hard to calculate.
Well, it's the world of modern media, David.
Keeping an eye on it is quite a job.
All right. Well, I want you to have a good weekend and stay safe, and hope you don't get too buried there in New York City.
I don't think it's going to be too bad. Same for you.
All right, David. We'll speak to you next week.
Bye-bye now.
David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Of course, you can find David on the web at his own website, themediabeat.us.